3, 2, 1. Steve Bloom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brilliant. What inspired you to start photography and pursue it as a career? Where did it all begin for you?
Well, I grew up in South Africa, and during the 1960s, we used to get copies of Life magazine. And I was absolutely intrigued and fascinated by it. There was no television in those days. It was actually banned in South Africa. In the 1960s, it was regarded as too dangerous. That, you know, it was during the apartheid era and they would suppress information. And I came across photographs by Eugene Smith and John Dominis and various others. And Life magazine, I was so absolutely enthralled and specifically by the black and white photography. And I got a box brownie. I mean, that's prehistoric by today's standards. And the whole tactile feel of film and loading the camera and so on, I absolutely loved. So, you know, that was the focus. And it wasn't until I was much older in the 1970s, when I was in my early 20s, inspired by the documentary photography in Life magazine, I went out and started photographing the whole apartheid world of South Africa, which I found very disturbing. I went into the townships, you know, often illegally, because these were very strictly racially segregated areas. And if you know, were a white person in an area designated for black people, you could have been arrested. And I found myself becoming more and more politically aware, and built up a body of work of South African situation. But I found, because I was interested in photography, I couldn't really make a living as a photographer that easily. I thought of becoming a press photographer, but I managed to get a job as a photo retoucher, as a gravure retoucher. And my job was to make color separations and to retouch the film. So I was always working with film and to retouch the film separations so that when they, this was before there were scanners, when they made the final print, the colors and everything were correctly balanced. And, you know, and then I started to experiment with photo montage all in the darkroom. So I was working in the photography field. So it was my whole life then. Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like? You mentioned growing up in that apartheid. What was it like growing up in South Africa? Could you go into a bit more detail about that and maybe some of the risks that you faced and things you saw?
Well, I mean, I didn't take big risks compared to a lot of other people I know. I'm new. I mean, you know, I came from a political family, a family who was opposed to apartheid, and I knew people who had been subjected to banning orders and had been put in prison and so on. So it was the world I lived in. It was very uncomfortable. And so as a white person growing up with such huge oppression on black people, I did feel a certain sense of huge discomfort by the fact that I could live in areas where others couldn't. I was allowed to do certain types of work that others based on color couldn't. So how do you deal with something like that? You either become an activist, or in my case, I took photographs. And it wasn't until 1977 that I put a bunch of photographs in a suitcase and came out to the UK and went to the anti-apartheid movement, who took some of these pictures. And also went to the International Defence and Aid Fund, which was a body under the auspices of the United Nations. Their role was to make people aware of apartheid. And so they used the pictures and they published them in books, and there were various exhibitions and so on. So it was the first time my photographs actually got seen. And I was granted asylum in the UK and eventually got UK citizenship as a result of that. So it was 13 years before I could go back, and I only managed to go back after Nelson Mandela was released.
Yeah. And was a big reason moving to the UK because of those tensions? Is that what kind of...
Yes, but I mean, if I can be absolutely honest, the UK offered far better career possibilities then. And so I worked again as a photo retoucher in Bristol for a few years before moving to London and setting up my own photo retouching company. And then I took in a partner, a chap called Phil Jones, who's remains a very good friend of mine. And we built up from there, mainly doing darkroom work and coming across many, many top photographers in the UK then, and working with ad agencies. And that's what I did for many years until 1993, when Photoshop came along and essentially destroyed our business because, was a different world. So I then became a wildlife photographer.
Yeah.
So I was involved in stock photography for a while. An interesting fact not many people know is that Ho Chi Minh was a photo retouch in Paris.
Really?
Before he went on to defeat the might of the United States military.
That's incredible. I did not know that.
He's the only photo retoucher who has a city named after him.
Yeah. So how difficult was that career transition from a retoucher to a wildlife photographer and kind of adopting digital cameras as well in the process?
Well, I started off in analog, and I was, I always loved photography. I read everything about it that I could, and it was my whole world. So to go from being a retoucher to a photographer was relatively easy, and it was when a friend of mine who ran a photo agency showed me a picture of a running cheetah, and he told me he makes £10,000 a year from that one photo just by licensing it. And it was at a transition period in my early 40s where the business I'd built up with a photo lab and the contacts with all the ad agencies wasn't paying off anymore. So I thought I'd go on a safari and take a number of photographs and see if I could sell them. And I put them with a photo agency called Planet Earth Pictures, which was eventually acquired by Getty, and realized I could start earning a living doing that. So that's how I got into the wildlife photography side of it. So I had this body of work, which was documentary black and white work, and then the next stage was the photo lab and the more technical side, and then it was going back to the creative side with the wildlife photography. And I realized then that one of the ways you could possibly make it as a wildlife photographer was that you really need books, because books have a huge reach. I mean, a book is an exhibition that people keep at home. But they're so important. More people see pictures when they're published as books. So my first book was published by a German publisher called Kernemann. And the first edition of that was in 10 languages, and it was nearly 250,000.
Wow.
With books down, I mean, nobody would print that many today.
Yeah.
A lot of things about a photography career is timing. It's going to be much harder now.
Yeah.
Stock photography. I realized that the way I was going to make a living out of it wasn't so much with books, but was with, at the time, stock photography. That's all changed now, because I'm talking about pre-digital. Everything was on film. So,
yeah.
And they weren't quick and easy scans as well. I mean, with stock photography originally, you'd make physical duplicate copies. And if a potential client wanted something, they would call you up and say, I'm looking for a picture of a charging rhinoceros, And then you would take a duplicate copy of that and you put it on a motorbike and send it to them. And then they would look at it on a light box and they'd ask a couple of other people. And then these bikes would come from different directions. I mean, you can, compared to now, it's crazy. But because of that, not many people were doing it. There were probably not more than a dozen full-time professional wildlife photographers then. So at that time, it was lucrative. It paid really, really well. And then I was using the books to get my name out. And then digital came along. And it made it easier. But because it made it easier, it also became much more competitive. And I think the easier something is to do, it's a bit of a paradox. It's also much harder to make a living doing, because then everybody's doing it. It's only the things that are hard and unique and really specialist that give you a niche and reduce the competition.
Yeah, definitely. I 100% agree. And like you were saying earlier, it's almost like you were riding the wave. So you were riding the wave of stock photography. And then once the competition got too high, you pivoted and then went to books.
Sure. I rode the wave of photo retouching when there were very, very few retouchers. Just rewinding, then the computers came along, the first computers. Now, this was before Photoshop. There was a machine called the Quantel Paint Box, which suddenly you could retouch on a computer. And we felt threatened. We were absolutely terrified because everything we were doing were in darkroom. We were using these wonderful De Vere enlargers and processing everything in chemicals and hand retouching onto prints and hand retouching onto transparencies. And suddenly a computer could do it. So my partner and I, we remortgaged our houses. We borrowed everything we could. We spent everything we had, and we had to raise a few hundred thousand in the late 1980s. In fact, it cost us close to £500,000 in 1988. That was a lot of money then. And we got this computer that had a 1 gigabyte hard drive, and it had software from Belgium. And the guy who wrote the software had to fly out and install it. And the computer itself needed its own air-conditioned room. This one gigabyte hard drive computer with 32 megabytes, not gigabytes, megabytes of RAM. The RAM alone cost £32,000, never mind the rest of the computer. But nobody else was doing it. We got the job of preparing the official posters for the Barcelona Olympics. 2 years ahead, and the Olympics people in Spain were very upset because they said it had gone to a Spanish company, but nobody there had the technology. And so we built up. So that was riding on a wave. We were able to charge a lot of money. We were, it was a good business model, and it worked. And we had highly paid designers for us. We had a whole team of about a dozen people doing this, and we were working 24 hours a day doing design work and doing the sort of things that people do in seconds on Photoshop, but with much more primitive equipment. And then the price of RAM dropped, and Photoshop, which was RAM dependent and still is very RAM dependent, we were dependent on accessing data from the hard drive, which was much slower, but a lot cheaper, because Photoshop needed so much RAM to do high resolution images that it was just unaffordable. But when RAM dropped, Photoshop became affordable, and suddenly, we were finding that there were people competing with us who were doing design work on computer, on Macs and PCs, in their spare bedrooms. So our turnover dropped, and then I thought, well, stock is the next wave. Right? There was really no real market for fine art photography prints then. And it was about that time there was a photo agency called Tony Stone Images, and they had a policy of making stock images high quality. Stock was always a sort of cheap, cheap, not very desirable product. Tony Stone raised the quality of it. And before we closed our business, he came to us and we produced his first catalogs, and this had never been done before. Stock photo catalogs where people would get, and this before there was, you know, the internet, and you would get these beautiful books and look through them. And instead of you having to put a picture on a duplicate transparency on a bike, they'd all have the catalogs and I'll have that one and that one. And so when I started doing the wildlife photography, I printed my own catalog of my own work. I, for a short time, I was with Planet Earth Pictures, but when Getty bought them, I left. I decided we would set up my own photo agency and sell picture licenses to people directly. And one thing Tony Stone taught me was that less is more. You don't need 50,000 images. Today, there are probably a billion pictures taken every day. Nobody knows. A billion with huge impacts on the climate, with the amount of energy it takes. I printed my own catalog, just a beautiful little book with the pictures in it, and I sent them out to various picture agencies. So, and then people came to us direct. Now, my wife, Kathy, who's a pharmacist, she gave that up and she became our photo library manager. So I was one of the very few people who had their own picture library and selling their work, selling licenses. That's how we made a living. That's how I was able to sponsor the trips, because it was very expensive. And we were still, in those earlier days, we were still using film. And even then, if I'd go to the Masai Mara in Kenya for a month, I would have a £3,000 or £4,000 bill then. And now we're talking the 1990s for film and processing. You know, none of this business of having a compact flash camera.
Yeah. Yeah. No, It makes me grateful for, like, kind of how easy it is for me. But then what you're saying is, because it's so easy, everyone can do it and therefore it's less valuable. So maybe, like, it is, like you're saying, it's kind of paradoxical. It actually was a good thing that it was hard, because a few people would be able to do it, which makes it profitable.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when I remortgaged my house and put all my money in, my wife was absolutely terrified what I was doing. We had two small children. You know, we had a child had just been born and another one was 2 years old, and I was throwing everything into this machine that kept overheating in its air-conditioned room to try and get... And we needed to charge £300 an hour time on this machine just to try to pay it back. And it was terrifying. But nobody else, because nobody else had it, and because ad agencies were doing these huge posters, and the work with the Barcelona Olympics was very, was hugely advantageous to us from a marketing perspective. What we're doing. But then, well, that died when Photoshop came along. And it's changing again, because now you have these huge AI challenges. And, you know, when photography came along, the painters were absolutely terrified. They thought, what are we going to do? We're going to be out of business. Someone can press a button and do what I spend 3 weeks in my studio with oil paints doing. What are we going to do? And it was a real fear for them. So they reinvented themselves, and Picasso came along with cubism, and eventually led to abstract expressionism, and photography and painting is continually changing and so on. And now I think photography has gone from analog to digital, then the ability to manipulate images. There was always ability to manipulate images. I used to manipulate images professionally before digital. But now I think we're reaching a new era where photography needs to find another way. And I'm intrigued by the way people make a living as a photographer nowadays. Making a living as a wildlife photographer is very, very, very difficult now. And a lot of people are doing tours. I've only ever done one tour. I found it distracts you. When I was doing the photography, I'd have my own guides, and they were expensive operations. But the concentration, the focus was absolutely total. So doing tours is a bit of a compromise, but an economic necessity, because you don't have to pay for film anymore. But that aspect of it is free. The equipment has improved so much, but because of that, the competition is just blown out of the up like you won't believe. It's hard. So I think with AI, there needs to be some kind of reinvention of photography in the way that artists, painters had to kind of reinvent the way they did. There's this bill going through Parliament at the moment regarding copyright, this crazy idea with the government you need to opt out, you need to list everything that you want to opt out of, otherwise AI will have a free reign. And I think the government doesn't understand copyright and doesn't understand the challenges. This is how we make a living. And, you can't just legalize theft. I mean, it's as if I said, or the government said, everybody's got to make a list of everything they own. And they've got to give it to thieves, and thieves can go through it. If anything of yours is not on the list, they're legally allowed to steal it. That is the absurdity of this bill.
It seems like, as well, how do you opt out a photo that's on the internet as well? Because it's basically everywhere.
You can't. I typed into ChatGPT, asked it to make a picture of an eagle flying over a waterfall. It's so close to one that I did, right down to the rock formations. After this interview, I'm planning to post it on Instagram. And of course, once you put something on Instagram, Meta says, it's something for us to put into our AI. So, and you can't survive without it. So the thing that I think about a lot is what are we going to do now? What are we going to do collectively as photographers, as artists? This whole stock thing for me is finished. I've essentially shut down my photo library, and I'm now moving more into producing sort of a gelatine or printing on Japanese paper. And I'm building up now an archive of fine art prints and shutting. The two can't exist side by side. You know, they're photographers who would never touch stock, and they're stock photographers who could never go into fine art. And so they're separable. So pushed one aside and I'm moving into the other. And the challenge is the uniqueness of the print. After being at Photo London and seeing how what people were doing, I think the way forward is to turn photographs back into unique, valuable objects. I mean, I have, from my South Africa days, a number of vintage silver gelatin prints. These can't be repeated. They can't go back in time. It's a finite number, and that gives them the value. I think where people just churn out numerous inkjet prints and they're all identical, I think even if they're additioned, I think you have to be very careful in that way. So I'm experimenting with taking photographs and mixing them with paint and doing painting with acrylic on photographs, just trying to give them a unique aspect, a new unique element. And I think that will give them volume. Because the other thing is, we are so bombarded with images and our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And I wish TikTok had never been invented, because that's, you know, I thought Instagram and all these others were bad until, and because we, you know, when people look at photographs now on their phones, they're doing that.
It's like fast food almost.
Yeah. And somehow we've got to find a way of slowing down and almost a zen-like approach to photographs. One bit of advice I often give to young photographers is who are shooting digitally is pretend you've got a roll of 20 exposure film in there. And you've got to think carefully before you press the shutter. This idea that you take a picture and edit later. You should be mindful in your approach to it.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I know David Yarrow and Ansel Adams both kind of have that similar mindset of visualizing seeing the picture and planning the picture before you actually take it. And so you're saying with the prints, it's not good enough to just create these inkjet prints. It's also important to create these prints on amazing paper and possibly making it an edition of one, like a almost work of art. Do you think that's the way forward?
I'm going to quote Ansel Adams. He, you know, he was also a musician, and he likened the negative to a musical score and the print to the performance.
Yeah.
And that is so important. All the subtle darkening here and lightening there, and just controlling the light. I mean, in the old days, it was, you didn't need Photoshop. You had you'd use your hand to dodge, and you'd put on a piece of coat hanger, a little bit of cutout paper, and you presume you know the whole process. I think it's very important for people to learn darkroom techniques, even if they don't practice it, because I think it gives you an understanding of the slowness in making pictures. And then, of course, with darkroom prints, each one was different. There would be subtle differences. There are too many images for us to be able to absorb them and to give them value. If I can just go back to imaging licensing and stock photography, I only had about 100 images that I made a quite a good living out of when we were licensing them directly. And now the agencies boast they've got millions and millions and millions. You can't edit, you can't sort millions. You only need a small number of good images to have an identity. If you think of any of the legendary photographers, whether you're thinking of Richard Avedon or Irving Penn or any of these guys, one or two pictures come up in your head that you've noticed. You don't, your brain can't accommodate 20,000 of their pictures. You don't need 20,000 pictures, you know. Vermeer, I think he only painted something like 20 something in his whole life, and they're all just incredible. And so that for me is important in an approach to photography, to not just keep producing more and more and more and more.
Yeah, it's limiting what you show to the world. You know, you can take 10,000 images, but only maybe 10 or 1 or 2 are actually going to be valuable enough to make any profit from.
Exactly. And it also impacts on people's perception of a photographer. if you're showing a portfolio and you're coming in with 300 pictures, they're going to get, whoever you're showing it to is going to get tired. If you come in with 10 and they are, and each one is absolutely amazing, and they reach number 10 and they think, wow. And they're not going to be disappointed by number 15 or number 20 or 30 or whatever.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, less is more. Like scarcity does definitely add value, especially if you're doing a fine art career. Do you think fine art is the wave then to go for, especially with AI?
I think it is. And I didn't go that route earlier on in my career because, to be honest, the stock route at the time was much more lucrative. But interestingly, fine art, it's still a challenge. And I listened to an absolutely fascinating podcast a couple of months ago with Paul Graham, and he was talking, and I remember him from the 1980s, Bristol, and you know, he has a very he's very well known, and he's very successful, and his work is in top museums, and but he spoke about the real challenge and how, you know, he was struggling financially earlier on, and with fine art photography, like anything else, you can be the flavor of the month 1 month, and then you can be dropped by galleries when somebody else comes along. Now, I just had an informal general chat with one of the top photo galleries, blue chip, selling the work of top art photography artists. I won't say who it is. I had a chat with them at Photo London the other day, and he was telling me that it's a struggle. He said the hardest type of art to sell is photography, and that's the sphere he's in, because there is this perception that photography is easily reproducible. And that's why I think the prints have to be something special, like platinum palladium prints. I've had some platinum palladium prints done. They're absolutely beautiful. They're very expensive to make, which is a problem, but that also gives them the value because they're so expensive to make and because they've got this wonderful metal in them. And you have these depth and the shadows that is just can't be simulated with any other process.
Speaking of digital and how accessible that is, everyone's got a camera on their phone. Mm. Do you think another way to differentiate yourself and go to a low competition area is to actually shoot analog and then create amazing prints? Do you think that's a way to increase the value of your work?
It is, but it's not just the process. You need, if you want to increase the value of the work, you need people on your side. You need to have a certain amount of business acumen. And a lot of the most creative people in the world are not very sociable, can be quite withdrawn, can have certain types of ADHD issues, and I'm not saying this in a negative sense. I'm saying that this is what gives them their incredible creativity, but it makes it harder for them to promote themselves. And it's so often the case. I think I can also be quite bad at promoting myself when I'm in a real creative mode. So shooting analog can only be part of it. You've really got to be able to have people on your side, people who will promote you, people who will support you, in order to give you that those openings. But I think the most important thing is to create great work. And if you can create great work and then find inroads from there, that's why, I mean, you know, you can send people emails, but people get a million emails a day. Well, not a million, but maybe some do. And they can't physically process at the galleries. So how else can you get to be seen by them? There's a like music and acting and so on, there are very, very, very talented people around, brilliant people, but there's only a small number who can get to those who will enable them to make a good living. So,
like, how do people starting off make great work, but also how do they learn those business skills and those branding skills that'll potentially get them into galleries? What's some like key tips for that?
I think the first thing is to produce great work and not in huge volume, and to be different, be yourself. Don't look at another person and say, well, I love that person, but I'm going to try and produce work like theirs. If yours stands out and resonates with people, well, also the prints have got to be beautiful quality. And I think so often now with the modern technology, it's easy to just press print on the inkjet printer. I think learning about, study the works of people like Ansel Adams, who was a master printmaker. You know, look at pictures by Eugene Smith or Irving Penn. Irving Penn is somebody who I often cite as a wonderful example, because he was a great fashion photographer, but he took photographs of cigarette ends, which, in fact, at the moment, Hamilton's gallery have got some on show. And he produced platinum palladium prints with them. But as far as I'm aware, he didn't just put the negative on the paper. He multiple exposed them. He would coat it and expose and coat it. So he built up a depth. Now, those are some of the most exquisite prints I have ever seen. They are mind-blowing. And the subject matter, cigarette stubs. But they're beautiful. And I think that's what... That is an incredible achievement, to take the most mundane, ordinary, boring subject and make it into something so beautiful that people covet it and want it on the wall. So, you know, that's a way. It's not easy. It's no one's pretending it's easy. And also have your own sort of unique stamp on your work that's identifiable as yours. That's somebody you look at that and say, you know, you look at Bill Brandt and you have those shadows, and you know immediately it's a Bill Brandt image. And that's photography. And that's, good people can be at the same thing and take photographs and they'll be different. And you know.
I guess that comes through repetition as well, and practicing and studying the greats as well. And yeah. A lot of hard work, and you were saying it's difficult to make these prints, but if it was easy, like we were saying earlier, everyone would do it, and then it wouldn't be valuable. You mentioned books earlier. Do you think that's still a good way to kind of brand yourself and get your photos to more people?
Absolutely. But it's also very challenging, because there are the mainstream book publishers, and I mean, I've had 15 books published in 22 languages, so... I was there at the right time. I know it's much, much harder now. And then you don't think of books as a money-making thing, but as a calling card, as advertising. And it's extremely successful in that regard. But publishing a book alone isn't the hard part. The hard part is finding somebody who can get it translated into other languages, finding a distributor, or getting it distributed. Now, all the top publishers have distribution challenges, and it's a very expensive process, because just the warehousing, the storage, if a book doesn't sell, it sits in a warehouse and you have to pay rent to the warehouse. And, you know, for the publishers, they have to pay the salespeople, they have to try and get them to get a book in the window of Waterstones. It's not that easy, because there are thousands and thousands of books. You know, if one book publisher is publishing 150 books a year, which is what they, and then there are hundreds of book publishers. How many can fit in Waterstones window? How many will get onto the shelves of Waterstones? And that's, you know, it's not just Waterstones. There's Amazon and other bookshops. And, you know, there's so many thousands. How do you get a tie up on the search engines? These are all difficult challenges. And I think from a book point of view, you really need to, you can self-publish, you can kickstart. I know people have done very well with Kickstarter crowdfunding programs. And so they market them beforehand, they sell a lot beforehand. But these are all challenges. But don't go and throw all your money at self-publishing something, and then you've got a couple of thousand books delivered to you, and you think, well, how am I going to get these out to an audience? It's a program of events, and you've got to plan ahead all these other things if you're going into books.
And how do you approach publishers and distributors when you have an idea for a book or you're thinking of making a book? What are some tips for that?
The tip is to have a very, very clear proposal, a clear idea. And the publisher's going to want to know what sets it apart from something else. They're going to want to know why you think they are the right publisher for it. They're going to want to know what the competition is. So they're going to want to know what similar books have been published and, you know, how you'll fit in with that and how you'll complement that. And then they're going to want to know the unique selling points. And you have to say it's going to reach this audience, and it might be of interest to students and people in conservation. And then, you know, you need to have a very clear biography of what you need to let them know what you will do. I think what's important now is the photographer's own social media presence, because the publisher's going to want to know how you will be able to help them with regard to getting the word out. You know, there wasn't social media like there is now when I was having my books published.
I guess that makes it easier, but also harder, because you have to put in an effort to grow your social media. But once your social media is a large enough number, that will attract publishers. But it's just that first step of growing your social media.
I saw an interesting guy on Instagram who's got a huge number of followers, and he's a wildlife photographer. And someone films him making the photograph, and then you see the photograph. And I think that is his business model as a wildlife photographer, rather than, seeing other ways. And so many people on Instagram seem to think he's an influencer and makes a living through the sheer hundreds of thousands of people who see his, if not millions, who see his posts. I mean, I'm in my 70s now. Well, that's a bit ahead of me. And I sort of look at that with my eyes wide open, saying it's amazing that there are ways in which people are sustaining themselves that you could never have dreamt of 20 or 30 years ago.
Definitely. And I think growing that, and maybe also combining that with fine art, because you have a reputation from social media, that might be difficult to do. But if you can kind of like merge both of them things together, like a few photographers are doing, that's ideal. You were saying earlier about having a minimum amount of photos, like keep it small, less is more for quality of your work. How many photos do you need in a book compared to in a fine art gallery or to show to a gallery? What's the minimum amount of books you feel should be included in a book?
Okay, the biggest book I did, which came out in 2004, was called Untamed, and that was in 10 languages, and that was really big. It weighed 4.5 kilos, 240 pictures in that, and over 400 pages with double page spreads. That's the most I've had in a single book, but It depends on the text. It depends on the layout. Good design is very important. And just keep them with strong pictures. So I would say 100, 120. There's no clear answer to it. In a book, 40 or 50 pictures is probably too few. But then again, if it's nicely laid out, if you've got lots of pictures on the page, it can be a bit crowded. But if it's nicely spread out and laid out, it could look quite good. Design is important. Good book design is so important. You know, there's the Tate Gallery holds an annual event called Outprint, which I went to last week, and it was absolutely packed. And then these are alternative publishers and alternative art books and everything. And I just found, from a personal point of view, I mean, I wish them all well. I just found myself completely and utterly overwhelmed with volume. And there were very few gems among them that I saw. The rest was just volumes of self-indulgent stuff, and I don't think that's going to stand the test of time.
Yeah, definitely. And can you tell me a bit about the backstory behind your outdoor exhibitions? Because
yes,
they're just incredible, and I'd love to know how you got around to doing those.
Thank you. I've had 17 of them. The real problem with that is financing them. They were very expensive. Jan Artus Bertrandt did Earth from the Hen. I don't know if you remember that book, but it was a millennium book when the year 2000 came along, and he hired helicopters around the world, and he told me something like 3 million books, which is a phenomenal achievement. And it just pictured, there were no drones. Then you see, that's new timing, crest of the wave. You couldn't do that now. And he had a series of outdoor exhibitions, big outdoor exhibitions. There was one outside the Natural History Museum. He had one in Amsterdam and such. So I went with the same publisher. His book, Earth from the Air, was exactly the same size as my Untamed, same picture, same publisher, same distribution network. Everything about it was the same. And so I approached the people who organized his exhibition. So he was first, he put them alongside the Luxembourg Gardens in Paris as the first outdoor exhibition. And it was such a success, he ended up having them elsewhere. So I contacted a company called We Communicate and another one called Earth Matters in Scandinavia. And then they started putting up these exhibitions, and they were hugely successful, but they would have to get sponsors. You know, you needed security at night. You needed lighting. And then they would set up a shop. So at that point, there were my books, and then I printed posters and postcards. And I think we sold about 1 million postcards at the one in Denmark. The one in Denmark broke the record for the most visitors at any exhibition in Denmark's photography exhibition, Denmark's history. So, you know, that's how we did it. We went to Amsterdam, Stockholm, Stavanger. We had an exhibition in Moscow when Russia was okay to visit before all this horrible business happened. It says reconnecting. You're there. Okay, sorry. Okay, you might have to edit that. Jump out. So we would set up a tent and just sell our products related. So we started producing our own products. And then there'd be other things like jigsaw puzzles and so on, because ultimately, you know, you have to make a living doing this. So I had all these exhibitions, and they were a very, very good way of promoting the work. And raised my international profile in a very positive and very effective way. And the prints were absolutely huge, and they were, I can't tell you offhand in terms of meters, but big, 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 big. And they were Fuji Crystal Archive chromogenic prints. They weren't inkjet, and they were mounted onto dye bond. So they were very expensively produced. They were produced as fine art prints, that people used the same process to make high-end fine art prints. They were photographic prints, chemical prints. And then they had an ultraviolet laminate over them, because they'd sometimes be 5 or 6 months out in the sun. So, you couldn't have them fading.
How did you get finance for those? Was it a lot of sponsorships, or was it a lot of
sponsorship? Yes, sponsorship was important. And I mean, like in Russia, British Airways and the British Council were very helpful. We had the support of the various mayors' offices. There would be some advertising associated with it, and then it would be through book sales. Of course, the organizers, they also needed to have their costs covered.
So how did you contact those organizations? Was it you emailing people, or was it someone else doing it for you and getting
They weren't doing many outdoor exhibitions. There were very few. They could only really do one at a time. It wasn't like a publisher publishing hundreds of books.
You photographed wildlife and humans extensively. How does photographing humans differ from wildlife, and which do you find more challenging and rewarding?
That's probably the most difficult question you've asked me. I think it's what I'm photographing at the time that I become totally absorbed in. So if I'm photographing people, I'm totally absorbed in it, and I'm not making a comparison. I'm the same with the wildlife. There's the total immersion. It's a strange thing. You can be unusual sense of time when I'm photographing. And even when I was doing all these wildlife trips, ironically, I didn't really experience much of the wildlife while I was doing it, because I was totally absorbed and totally focused, no pun intended, on getting the image. And one of the trips I made to Antarctica, a friend of mine said to me, why don't you put your camera down for a day and just absorb the environment and just look? And I thought, actually, I can't. Every day is expensive. I've got to make it work. But I did. I think of the last day, I didn't take a camera out. I walked around and looked. I saw more and experienced more in that day than I did in the whole rest of the trip.
Wow. Do you do that now, since that trip? Is that a thing that you've kind of remind yourself to do?
I do. I'm not photographing so much anymore. I'm certainly not doing the expedition trips. I mean, those were physically grueling. And I only started those in my 40s when I after we shut down the photo lab. I'm just going back into my archive and I'm re-editing things. And I'm finding new ways of doing things. I'm doing painting and I'm experimenting with collage. And photography, I love photography, but the photographic image has its challenges. David Hockney has described the photograph as a one-eyed person looking down a long tube for a split second, whereby painting you looking around. Now, that might upset a few photographers, but I think that's a very valid statement. The abstract expressionist Gerhard Richter, who's the German painter, artist, absolutely love his work, and he's worked with photography, and he used to paint photorealistic paintings. And he feels the photograph is too flat, it isn't real, and there's more realism in a painting. So I did a little experiment the other day. I took photographs of elephants I had, and I printed it onto this beautiful Japanese paper, and I made a few prints of paper, and I tore them, and I montaged them onto a canvas. And then I painted around it with oil paint of all the, real thick impasto painting with texture in it you'll never get in a photograph. And I left bits of the photograph shining through. And I felt the bits of the photograph looked too flat. So eventually I covered everything with oil paint. So now I have this oil painting with the photograph lurking behind, completely invisible. You don't see the photograph at all. And, I know Gerhard Richter has started off with a photograph and ended up with this abstract expressionist image. And I feel that there's a lot in paint that you still can't achieve with a photograph. And for me, the challenge, I don't know, again, you probably edit this back, whether you want to edit some pictures into your presentation. So I can show you. So this elephant picture, now when you look at that next to the original photograph, and I've done that with some other things as well. I've taken a photograph and I've tried painting it, but with thick paint, and there's a texture that's not in that photograph. So for me, the challenge is, and I don't have an answer, I don't know if anybody's got the answer, I would love to know, how do you get the texture and the feel of expressionistic painting into a photograph? How do you lose that flatness, that totally smooth surface that you don't? How do you get Jackson Pollock into a photograph?
Yeah, exactly. My mind just goes to like somehow creating this like 3D printer that slightly like creates slight textures of the image, but that might be a long time coming for that to be created.
There is, I don't know too much about it, but I think, and I can't be sure of this, but I think Factum Art here in Madrid can do that. And they're a company that make the most incredible reproductions of oil paintings. And I think they do a 3D scan for that. And then they print, they've got a flat. But these are sort of expensive things. How to get that? But it just shouldn't be a random texture. It's got to leap out at you. And maybe in the way, now this is an interesting, maybe in the way that photography terrified painters, so they went out and invented cubism and expressionism, and out of that came people like Mark Rothko. Maybe out of where photography is now, as I say, necessity is the mother of invention, we might find new ways of making photographs to counter. I mean, what's going to happen with AI? It generates an image, and then it's going to carry on generating images, and eventually it's going to become quite incestuous, as it's going to be using its own generated images to be able to make more generated images. And there's all this sort of AI interbreeding will produce deformed images, but then AI will learn while it goes along not to do that.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, isn't it?
It is.
I think that we should have hope for the next generation of photographers and like future photographers, because, you know, like you said, you either have to kind of adapt or die. And with AI, yes, that's probably the biggest challenge photographers have faced. But like you were saying about cubism, you know, the painters that came about when photography kind of became more commonplace, they adapted. Mm. And, you know, you see Picasso's work selling for hundreds of millions of pounds. So it's clearly a way. And maybe this challenge has a lot of benefits because it's going to challenge photographers to create better work and separate themselves from the crowd. That's the hope.
Sure. I mean, it is terrifying. But you know, when Photoshop came along, a lot of photographers were terribly threatened And they said I would never touch Photoshop with anything. And it's now part of the work, the workflow. You don't have to be deceitful. You can, you know, if you're altering light and you're just making more balanced prints and maybe doing some minor retouching, you know, that's okay. They now use, now AI is a big terrifying thing. And again, I think people will adapt and change because you have to. You're forced to. You know, when people are in a corner, that's when they're often in their most inventive. So I look forward to seeing where it's all going to go. And I think, you know, it is frightening. For me, the copyright issue is, with regard to AI, is a problem. That is a problem because, as I said, I've had my images, I've had AI generate images from prompts, only from, just from typing, make an image of, and it finds mine on the internet and everybody else's. You know, that's a problem.
Yeah, and do you think there'll be a whole generation of AI artists and photographers that end up having work in galleries, maybe similar to photographers, having their photos in art, like in galleries, like artists do? Or do you think that's not going to happen? Do you think there will be a kind of industry for that?
You mean AI images in galleries? I think that's happening already.
Yeah, and AI art.
Yeah.
Really?
I recall seeing some examples of that sort of thing, and people selling AI art. You know, is that going to be a fad? Is that going to have lasting value? I think you need to think in terms of what's going to have the best lasting value. What's, and maybe that goes down to the uniqueness of the print. I mean, going back to Photo London, looking at original prints by Bill Brandt and André Cartes and Cartier-Bresson, and these people, they were the previous analog age, and those original prints, they can't be copied or duplicated. They have the value that paintings have because they're originals. And as long as they have that, they'll have the value. But when you can just sort of generate these things endlessly, and they might look pretty for a while, I don't think they will stand the test of time in the way that a lot of vintage photographic works of art from top names will.
Yeah, I agree. Unless they found a way to make the printing process an art itself, like photographers have. I imagine them kind of creating an image that is like unique, and then it's whether they can turn that into something physically valuable, because I feel like at the moment it is just too digital. I was just wondering as well, what are the few things that separate a pro photographer from an amateur? We've mentioned kind of being a master at printing, but I was just wondering if there's any other things off the top of your head that you can think of that separate the pros from the amateurs.
I think you do need to have that business sense, or if you don't, you need someone to help you. And the way that, I mean, I probably haven't mentioned enough how my wife, Kathy, was the business side of the work. And she enabled me to go on these trips around the world. There was one year I did 50 individual trips photographing, and I'd come back and she would make the business contacts. And so as a pro, you need pro means professional, you make a living out of it. You have to sell those pictures. And that is hugely time consuming. So that's important, and you have to be good at marketing, and you have to be advertising, you have to promote in various ways. So perhaps that's what it is. I have no doubt that there are people who don't make a living doing photography who are producing the most stunning work, absolutely stunning. And I think the amateurs are the ones who are doing it for the absolute joy of it, and it's fantastically beneficial for mental health. There's so many people who've had real sort of emotional and mental health problems who've turned to photography and found it helps them so much to deal with who they are and what they're experiencing. Because what you do when you're an artist, you make something that you put out. A lot of amateurs that might not be making a living doing photography, but it's really beneficial for their mental health. And, it's a wonderful thing to do. And that's why it's so popular. That's why there are so many millions and millions of amateur photographers. Some of them are producing absolutely outstanding work.
Yeah, I definitely got into photography the exact way you just described. When I was 15, I was like, it was lockdown. Obviously, as a teenager, you go through a lot of insecurities and things, and I, you know, was struggling a little bit, and I stopped going out in nature for that period of time. And then I got a camera. Then I started going out in nature with my camera after school, or like I said, during lockdown. And that really helped me discover myself and express myself and give me more confidence. So I completely agree with what you're saying there. It just, I think combining nature and photography, not just nature, but for me anyway, just observing what was around me, seeing the robins or blackbirds in my garden or in my local orchard, and just being more present and aware. I think that's an incredibly big benefit of photography, especially when you're just starting out.
Absolutely, it does. There are two aspects to it. When we're out in nature, it really gives us a sense of our space in the world. Every morning at 6 o'clock, we live in the countryside. I go for a 1 hour walk through the woods, and there's nobody around. It's wonderful. So, photography and nature, they're a perfect marriage. And the other thing is, when you're an artist and you produce photographs, it's something you want to share. You make something of yourself that you want to give to the world and you want to share with the world. And that's what the creative drive is. If you're a musician or a painter or a photographer, you want to make something that you want others to enjoy, that you want to share. And that's the huge emotional benefit. And that's why it's so good for your mental health, because it connects you with other people.
Definitely. I think having social media, and the fact that social media exists, helps you connect with people quicker than maybe a few decades ago. And it makes you be able to find that kind of audience and group of like-minded people. I was also just wondering what sacrifices you've had to make to pursue such a unique career that requires travel. You said you've traveled like 50 times in 1 year, made 50 trips. I was just wondering what sacrifices have been necessary to pursue this.
Well, it was exhausting. I mean, I only started the wildlife photography in my 40s. So, it's never too late. The biggest sacrifice was the fact that I missed aspects of my children growing up. I mean, I'd obviously come back and be with them, but, the times I was just at home, but there would be lots of times where I'd be away for a month or two and not see my children. And so that was the hardest thing. Of course, not see Kathy as well at that time. She was so busy selling the pictures.
If you could only photograph one animal, what would it be?
It's not something I give much thought to. And I tell you why I can't really answer that, is because I'm going to bring you back to the analogy with the cigarettes and Irving Penn. You should be able to, if you photograph, whatever you're photographing, you should do with total interest. Their session I probably enjoyed the most. In fact, it was a series of sessions. I made 3 trips to India to photograph an elephant swimming underwater. And that was for the book Elephant that I did with Tamsin Hudson. And that was probably the most emotionally rewarding. It was such a privilege and a pleasure to swim with all the scuba diving gear and a whole team of people who were helping me. and just to photograph the elephant swimming. And I had no experience as an underwater photographer, and I had no scuba diving experience. I had to do a crash course, and with a lot of help from a lot of people, I was able to get some images I was very happy with.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, they're incredible photos. I absolutely love them. Okay. I was also wondering, have you got into any dangerous situations when you've been out in the field shooting?
Sometimes the most dangerous things involve human beings. When I was photographing gorillas in the Democratic Republic of Congo, at a time when there was a lot of political unrest and there were no mobile phones, and just dealing with people and roadblocks and permissions and people wanting bribes and all sorts of things, that was difficult. And I was out of contact with Kathy for about a month, and she was very worried. I was just sort of disappeared, photographing, because there were no phones. There was no internet contact then. Otherwise, I mean, I've been charged by a rhinoceros. That was a bit scary, but the rhino swerved out of the way. I was covered in dust, and so, yeah.
What, so did you try and get out of the way, or did it, you just accept no, it and the, then it just the, worked, swiveled out?
The guy tried to fire a warning shot into the air. He would never have shot the rhino. He tried to just fire a shot in the air to scare the rhino, and his rifle jammed. And the driver tried to start the Jeep, and the Jeep engine wouldn't start. But it was so quick anyway that even if he'd fired him, he still wouldn't have got his warning shot fired in time. You know, you can't start a Jeep and drive away from a rhino that's charging you. But the rhino put on its rhino brakes and swerved. And I took a photograph of it coming towards me full speed. Got that one. So I got the picture, you know.
Yeah. I was also wondering how much research plays a role in these big projects and photographs, because I think...
Research is huge, and that's one of the things that Kathy was very involved in. For example, if I'd see a picture in National Geographic or something of a specific animal, I'll think, okay, I want to go there. And then you go there and it's out of season. The animal at that particular time wouldn't have been in that particular area. So we had a research, which was the right time. Then you have to research to find guides and people on the ground to assist you. So there was a huge amount of groundwork in order to put teams together.
Yeah. And how long did that process take compared to how long you were actually in the field for most projects on average?
It's difficult to quantify because it varied from project to project, but it was intensive. You had to do a lot of searching and researching.
And what was that process like? Was there a lot of just reading books and scrolling through the internet and finding contact?
Yes. Yeah, it was multiple things. You know, and the internet wasn't as advanced as it is today. You couldn't just ask chat or Grok or whatever. You had to do a lot. And a lot of the information wasn't on the internet yet, because the internet was in its early embryonic stages.
Yeah, it must be much more difficult. To end, I've just got a few quick questions to ask you, if that's okay. What is something that you believe in that many people tend to disagree with you on, if anything?
I think that if you have a dream, an ideal that seems absolutely unfeasible or impossible, it can be achieved. If you want to take up photography, it's a lot of challenges, a lot of difficulties, but you can do it. If you put everything in place and be diligent and work at it, you know, things that might seem impossible dreams are actually achievable.
Definitely. That's a brilliant answer. Thank you. If you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Take more pictures, work harder. I'm in my 70s now. I've had some very serious health issues in the last few years, but I'm full of energy now. And now I'm very aware that I'm not going to be around forever. When you've kind of been through what I've been through, you become aware of your own mortality. And if there's anything I regret, I didn't put more time and more effort in. I always feel I didn't do enough, but maybe that's kind of what everybody goes through.
Yeah, maybe. I think you seem to be one of the people that have done so much and gone to so many places. But I mean, I guess there's always that feeling that you can do more. But Steve Bloom, ladies and gentlemen, Steve, I absolutely love your work and hope the audience found your wisdom as useful as I did. What projects are you working on at the moment? You said you mentioned a bit of painting.
I'm doing some painting. I'm re-archiving some of my earlier pictures for a book project where I'm working with the analog pictures and going back to the analog images and just reprinting them. I love grain. I love the texture of grain. I love the sandpapery grittiness of grain. And in this world of hyper-realistic plastic-looking digital images, I'm going back into the archive and I'm reorganizing some of the early stuff.
Brilliant. That's the signs of a true artist, Steve. Where can people go if they want to find your work?
SteveBloomPhoto.com or SteveBloom.com.
Brilliant.
Instagram
is... I'll leave the links to your books as well.
And Instagram is at SteveBloomPhoto.
Brilliant. Yeah. Like I said, I'll leave everything people to check out your work in the show notes below. And really appreciate your time, Steve. Your images have had such an effect on me. And hopefully see you in person at some point when we're both nearby to each other.
Thank you. I'm very grateful for your compliments, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.